Welcome to Weekly Wings, your go-to podcast from DroneLife.com, where we soar through the latest in drone technology, regulation updates, and exciting innovations. Each week, join Samuel, Terry, and I as we navigate the drone industry, offering expert insights, interviews with key figures, and a bird's-eye view of how drones are shaping our world. From commercial applications to recreational adventures, Weekly Wings delves deep into how these remarkable vehicles are impacting construction, education, agriculture, filmmaking, delivery services, and so much more. Whether you are a professional operator, a hobbyist, or just drone curious, tune in and stay informed and inspired as we explore the heights of what's possible in the world of drones. Subscribe now and never miss an episode of Weekly Wings, where boom, the future is looking up. Almost, Terry.
I knew it.
I think it was a pretty good intro.
We might have to shorten that. We'll have to record that. As I was kind of looking at it, I was like, we're going to have to hit record. We're going to get some cool video to play. It's going to be a perfect opening video in about a month, maybe. We'll get to work on that. But welcome, everybody. Thank you for tuning in again. We're going to have a great episode here. We're going to dive into some of the, you know, privacy stuff that's come out, some recent court rulings that we've seen. We're going to do a tech spotlight on some of the military stuff we've seen recently, which we kind of touched on at the end of our first episode. We still are looking for that Q&A and that listener engagement, questions from the audience. So we're not there yet. So we'll be looking at Verizon and NOAA and what they're doing in preparation for hurricane season. Then we'll touch on a little another nugget of Drone Light Show record. And finally, we'll just highlight part 105, a new final ruling that's come out in regards to safety management systems. So it's kind of a quick run through of where we're going to be going in this episode. And with that, I know Terry, there's something that kind of interested you. You said that you were a little interested in, as far as more drones are going to be flying in the air and people are starting to discuss, you know, what privacy rights do people have, maybe what we can expect, and who's speaking for the non-drone operators. I think we had that article in DroneLife.com about Jim McGill was able to sit down and interview individual Mr. Stanley with the ACLU in regards to drones being used by police departments, the future.
Yeah, I mean, so it's the future, but it's, I believe you can use them for some things, but I feel like just spying on people probably isn't the best thing to use them for. I mean, America it's the land of the free, you know, you can't just start pushing in on people. But I mean, that's not me swallowing the red pill or anything. That's just me voicing my opinion.
But is there a difference between a drone that's 24/7? I think in the article here, part of the discussion was like drones that are in the air 24/7, just like constantly surveilling a community, as opposed to using drones, right, for a first responder type of scenario, right? Where it's when the call comes in, we know the location, and it's very specific, you know, use case versus like, we're just wide area.
Yeah, I don't think constantly surveilling the area with just a 24/7 drone. I mean, if you go down that path, we're going to have social credit scores, kind of like China. I think if it's using a first responder situation, I think that's okay. Like seeing if there's somebody's hurt potentially up in the mountains or something. Just like pathing the way for first responders to go to make it up the mountain safely would be like a use for it. But yeah, I don't like.
But maybe not like in this example here, where you know, we saw in the past week the Michigan Supreme Court case where you had the, you know, this individual, this couple with this land and property, and what we're seeing here is the drone. You know, the drone was flown and operated by what seems to be a contractor taking off and landing in order to capture photos and videos on at least three occasions over almost a 1 year period. So it goes into now maybe using this drone for surveillance versus
how do you feel about somebody coming on with their phone, just start hit record and just walking through your property and nitpicking you? I mean, it's the same thing, except it flies. So I don't know how much I like that.
Yeah, the 6 foot, I can't remember exactly where I was recently, but it was discussed. You know, you have that 6 foot privacy fence, you have that land where you just can't see everything from the road. And that's there's reasons that people prefer that type of property and that type of privacy. And then drones kind of change it because you can just, you know, elevate the drone. And I think that's the challenge, because if you see the drone, most people feel like if I can see the drone, then the drone can see me, even if the drone's pointed in the completely opposite direction. So the balance between, you know, even if we're looking at, you know, delivery drones, as those start to scale, you know, what is the end goal? And then, you know, what equipment is on board those aircraft? You can get a helicopter, the ability to, you know, put a helicopter in the air with a camera and do the same thing. So it's a more affordable aircraft, right? Sammy, I don't know if you have any, what your thoughts are here. I think that the fact that you can easily acquire a drone right off of Amazon, and I certainly don't, I got a fence in my backyard, but there's also property where you could stand on the property behind my yard and still see inside of my fence. So I can't yell at someone and say, hey, don't, you know, look down into my fence from that vantage point. It's, you know, the intent. And you're never going to know the intent, even with like remote ID, yeah. Right? When you can open an app and go ahead, Samuel.
I was just going to jump in real quick here. And I think what you just said is very important, is that intent. And it's really like, hey, you know, if you're like 300 feet above my property, am I really even going to notice that drone flying? Like, your intent may be to get a really cool shot that's a little bit farther away and you have to fly kind of near my place or adjacent to it or something like that. But when you're 100 feet, like 80 feet above my property, and it's like that, that's where it's going to bother me. And that's when it's kind of coming into, yeah, I may not own that exact airspace. However, you're literally, what are you doing there? Can you tell me what you're doing? And it seems like it's malicious intent, you know? I feel like that's kind of where it may not exactly be that. However, could you at least come talk to me and tell me what you're doing? And I feel like that's one of the, it's funny because I've also been on the other side. I've been the guy that's been flying and someone's been like, hey, what are you doing? And it's like, oh, I'm literally filming this. Let me tell you about it, but go ahead.
But the technology, when folks see the zoom capabilities, because you can be up at 300, 400 feet. And, you know, the drone's tiny, but what video is actually showing up? And mm-hmm. In this instance with the Michigan case, it seems like the drone was able to get video that even on the ground you couldn't collect, because I guess they were, you know, running an illegal salvage yard or junkyard, or they were, whether it was the town ordinances or from a business standpoint, you know, I mean, they multiple possibilities, whether it was all of their own vehicles piling up, were they then allowing people to pay them to come onto the property and get a door handle or get a seat, you know, all of a sudden it's grown to, you know, a full-fledged business operation. And they're like, yeah, but, you know, leave us alone. So I think a lot to unpack there. I have heard from folks in that public safety side that like a one-time flyover in passing, much like you could do with an airplane or a helicopter. Again, this is just a more affordable vehicle for getting an aerial image. There's no individual person on board. So when you look at the helicopter and the aircraft, you may not be recording, but you know, a sworn officer, member of the public safety is seeing something and communicating it. So I think there is some precedent where these aircraft have existed with this capability, but now it's more readily available. And so it's good to at least know that this stuff needs to get worked out. And you have both sides, you know, the ACLU is trying to represent the individual, the community, not the drone operator, and speaking out. And then you also, though, here in this instance, again, the Supreme Court for Michigan didn't rule on that underlying, you know, premise of the drone being used for surveillance. It was more or less on the fact that these individuals were violating the business and property allowances for that individual area. But Zoom capabilities, you know, even if that thing's
a tough one, because I mean, anybody can buy a drone. And anybody can put it up in the sky and just spy on anybody they want. it's just I hope people don't do that, but I'm sure there's been a few. I don't know how you would regulate that. I guess that's not really for me to decide. I'm not at that pay scale yet where I could start making those type of decisions. But I don't know how I feel about law enforcement not just coming onto your property. Like maybe one time. To just make sure everybody's doing what they're supposed to do. But even then, I feel like that's kind of infringing on people's rights to an extent.
I feel like this is kind of, I'm just going through this article and two kind of quotes that stand out. The key legal question really is whether drone surveillance, repeatedly flying a drone over somebody's property, was a search, Frommer said in an interview. However, according to the Supreme Court ruling in such a case as the one against the Maxons, even if they've deliberately violated your rights, they can still use the evidence in court. I don't know. I feel like I'm personally kind of seeing this as, oh, yeah, you know, this may have not been ethically the best thing we could have done. However, this is still the evidence we needed. This is like, ethically, should you be doing it? No. Is it going to help us in court and really prove our point and push it? Yes. So I don't know. That's what I'm getting from that specifically.
And
it's like it's just avoiding the search warrant, basically.
And this here that's being shared on the screen, just to speak to North Carolina, when it comes to, you know, state North Carolina general statutes, 15 alpha-300.1 prohibits anyone from using a drone to conduct surveillance of a person or dwelling occupied by a person or private real property. There are few exceptions, mostly for law enforcement purposes. So that's kind of, you know, broad search warrants, proper documentation, you know, what is the being able to kind of justify, but to who and how. But from an individual standpoint, $5,000 per photograph for any individual who violates that statute and intends to publish or disseminate photos, $5,000 per photo. So that's if you're doing, you know, the people have said in the past, well, if you're doing video at 60 frames per second, that's, you know, a lot of $5,000.
Yeah.
Adds up pretty quick there, huh?
It does. It does. But I think, again, it's kind of just the more drone, the more drones there are, right, the more likely people are to see them and then ask these questions. But I also think the more drones there are, potentially the more responsible operators are out there and flying and kind of, you know, showing and communicating exactly, you know, what the drones are capable of. But I think it's very much like satellite imagery or, again, traditional aircraft. This ability to see things from the sky has existed for a while. It's just becoming more noticeable. And then with DFR, drones as first responders, and the police surveillance side, it's balancing, like, you know, we don't need what drones monitoring for parking tickets and you know, going up and down streets for that type of parking violations. That seems a little overboard in my opinion, but being able to send a drone out when a call comes in for shots fired or a very high risk incident where sending a responding, either a first responder, EMT, police officer, could be more dangerous. Those are probably positive use cases that communities can get behind.
Yeah.
I can see what you're saying there.
And with that, with that kind of transitioning, I'm going to bring this up. We've got in our kind of tech spotlight and focus here, a couple vehicles up on the screen here now. Northrop Grumman, something, you know, Terry, you noticed over the past week and thought it would be really interesting to share with the audience, to speak about. What's on the screen here right now, Northrop Grumman's website. We're looking at a giant,
it's
uncrewed
massive
manta ray underwater vehicle. I don't know. It almost looks like an aircraft, slightly.
Yeah, they designed it to be as efficient as possible when going underwater. So it's just a submarine that works on its own, more or less.
UUVs. A UUV. I'm guessing unmanned underwater vehicle?
Yeah, that sounds
trying
right
to find a good idea of scale to kind of let our listeners know what we're looking
at. Yeah,
so
this thing is very deceiving. If when you look at it,
imagine science imitating life.
Very loud.
Yeah,
that's what our team is doing at Northrop Grumman. We're partnering with DARPA, developing Manta Ray.
Okay, this is not a video of the actual.
A new type of unmanned underwater vehicle.
Was that
so? If
very
you
loud
actually
for you,
go onto Google and just, yeah, it was very loud.
Was it?
It was, yeah, very, it was loud.
That's odd.
Yeah, so if you go into Google and you look up this thing and look for photos of it, there's not very many. Obviously, it's like kind of top secret. It's being developed for the military. This thing is massive. I don't have the exact scale, but I would say it's over 100 feet easily. This thing is really interesting because one of the key features is that it can go underwater, obviously, and it can sit on the bottom of the bed on the seafloor, and it can use the energy, the thermatic, that's not the right word, but the thermo energy, it can pull energy from the water, the heating of the water, and get it, like, produce its own energy and charge itself, and just kind of sit in an idle state while still being on. It's
for
like
reference,
the best submarine you can think of.
I was going to say, for reference, it literally looks like a giant manta ray, but in submarine form.
Yes, yes.
And we can see these
payload capable too.
We can see these, you know, folks right here standing on top of it in this image. So it's got to be 40 feet wide.
I'm curious what their practical use elements are here. I mean, I don't know. What are you going to do with your giant submarine manta ray?
Well, what are we doing with our, let's see, what are we doing with our submarines?
Yeah.
Where can this go that we haven't been before? Right? Because it eliminates the risk of human life.
Right.
Especially with the whole go look at the Titanic and the incident that occurred.
Yeah.
Right. So it's being able to go and explore areas that we haven't been before. Maybe from a military standpoint, it's a lot of this is being able to demonstrate capabilities, remote monitoring, remote areas, patrolling, maybe our own coastlines.
I see what you're
like
saying.
Like Terry said, being able to put payloads on it. So it's not that it's taking this craft now and folks being able to probably just integrate solutions into it. So with the appropriate payloads, it could monitor the coastline from a security standpoint, or maybe it could be doing research things.
I do actually mapping. Think it does some type of research. I've gotten a lot of my information of this thing off of TikTok, surprisingly. It's actually how I first
saw it. Oh, my goodness.
Hey, it's the modern world, okay? Let's see.
Built in Maryland, tested in California.
That's quite the trip. Wonder specifically why they chose California for testing.
I don't know exactly where they went, but I do know, having seen San Diego recently, that there's a huge military presence there.
Right.
Yeah.
It's probably due to the units as far as who would deploy this, who would manage it.
So I think the main use of this would be like... I mean, we don't need, like, let's say off the coast of Greenland or like somewhere in the Arctic, you just send this to just float around, just to survey, make sure nothing bad's happening. I'm assuming it has some type of technology to like see the temperature in the water, detect seismic activity, kind of like earthquakes and stuff, tsunamis. I'm sure it has those capabilities. I mean, it can sit on the bottom of the seafloor and gain energy somehow. So
you could send this into like severe storms, the same way they're taking fixed wing UAVs and they're flying them almost, right into these really intense storms where boats, you would not want to be around it. Something like this could potentially be operating, and again, just like Terry said, taking various readings that you would never want a human or even a traditional vehicle would be able to kind of handle that sort of weather.
So that picture right there that was on your screen, it actually has a piece that comes up and kind of like
share that again,
puts out information of where it's at to whoever's controlling it. And it's like almost like a radio for the outside world. So when it locks onto the floor to like recharge, that's what it uses. It's like a weird, it's like a rope that goes up.
Oh, you're going to have to, stay on top of this here, Terry, with your TikTok news.
Hey man, they're getting paid by. They got money. Okay. I'm sure this thing will be insane.
and so far, non-lethal manta ray. Didn't see any munitions so far. Second half of tech spotlight, the Rogue.
I actually haven't seen this one.
The Rogue. See, now you got to tell me. I'm not sure here. I had the volume turned off on my computer, so that's probably why it was so loud for you guys. How's this? Better?
Still a little high.
Yeah, I would put it about 25% probably.
Bravo 2, TOT 10 mics, 2 bigs, black lead.
Bravo 2 copies, 10 mics.
So, last week we talked about how commercial military overlap, two drones in a canister, pulls it out. What's really amazing is as I'm seeing this, I'm just thinking, video games. Video game development happened so fast in the late 90s, early 2000s. The quality of the real time.
BTR 90 on the train track. Got it. Switching to anti-armor payload.
But that ISR pod, I mean, that camera is so expensive. It has to be.
Dishka gun truck with 2 packs dismounted.
So on the thing, for folks that are listening visually, the video here playing is a Lockheed Martin video of the Rogue One drone. There's a tactical operations, a couple different drones deploying, launching, taking off. It's a white drone. It's got the payload looks like a traditional military ISR Gorgon Stare Predator drone. It's a quadcopter.
I'm assuming it's going to show what's lethal about it.
Yeah, here we're like going through the whole thing. Like, look at all this. It's got this little safety. It's got a safety, so now it's armed. So like in flight, it'll flip this switch, and then it's going to approach. We're seeing here, it shoots what looks like, I don't know, like, fragmenting warhead is what it's
like
explaining. Yeah. And then there's also in this other operation we're seeing the ability to basically fly this thing in an explosive penetrator warhead. So the drone can shoot munitions, the drone can, you know, kamikaze itself. And then the last bit here is showing how easy, which I think is positive in videos like this, to be able to show, like, oh, you know, can you disengage target? And apparently it has, you know, safe target disengagement for those instances when you accidentally activate it or last-minute information comes in. Couple tubes on the bag, got your Rogue One. Teledyne FLIR.
It's funny that you mention it reminds you of something out of a video game. All I can think of is we're getting closer and closer to living in Black Ops 2 every day we go forward.
And so and yeah, so it's just the when you see how drones are doing 3D visualization, just ground-based cameras are doing the 3D visualization. There was a period of time where, I mean, overnight, is this still playing audio? I gotta get this, stop that, okay.
It's not for us, if that counts for anything.
It's just, overnight, it was like the games went from just being like these made-up, creative, imaginative video games because you couldn't recreate real life in graphics with processing. And then all of a sudden there was this just ramp up where the football players looked exactly like they did on field and the jerseys and the stadium. So the realism was baked into these games. And then all of a sudden you're playing where you're deploying these drones, and the drones, you know, if you get a certain, like we talked about at the end of the last episode, you know, you get these streaks, you get these things, you know, you do well, and you're deploying high level drones with munitions, and or you're deploying these low level drones, and it's all a reality that's, I don't know if it was driven by video games because people saw that from a creative mindset. The game allowed folks to build it. And then the folks playing it now went to school and actually engineered and designed it and brought it all to life. But it is, it's all I was thinking when I was watching that Rogue One thing. And
does art imitate life here?
Definitely.
life.
Even the manta ray thing, like that manta ray looks like something from a movie, not necessarily any of the games that were played back. But when you watch like that type of movie idea where they take a concept that technology didn't exist, but it was like, we knew it would.
I'm thinking about Aquaman. I don't know if you guys saw that, but all I saw was his submarine right there. You know what I'm talking about, Jerry? I don't think you do.
But, I've never really watched Aquaman personally, but I think I know what you're talking about.
Throwing that out there real quick. But yeah, I mean, kind of going back to Paul's point is like current video game, like if you want to go get a degree in video games and whatnot, it's going to be something called like video game and simulation because... yeah, you're doing video games for fun and whatnot, but you can also do other things with that technology you're learning. You're learning how to simulate physics and math in real life and how to apply that. Like, people make drone simulators so that FPV guys won't go wrecking their drones all the time. They can just boot up the simulator, practice on that field, and get ready for a course. But kind of getting a little off topic with the given topic, but...
yeah, that's insane. It reminds me of the swarm from BO2, and then it also kind of, I think it was the dragonfly. It had the gun on it, so like the thing it shoots reminds you of the dragonfly, and then the swarm would just, there'd be hundreds of them, and they would just dip down and, you know, do what they do without getting too graphic. But that is insane. I wonder where the projectile comes from on that. I don't see anywhere.
And so you've got a payload, like this is your camera sensors, and you can see they've got a variety of payloads for, you know, various operations, maybe like a thermal, a night, a high zoom capability. But from what I'm seeing, you've got your arm disarm in this modular head. This is like a warhead, like in the sense of like, it is a, not a missile, but a projectile in itself propelled. So all this right here is packed with your kamikaze, for, you know, lack of the appropriate term here, warhead. And then your, from what I'm seeing in the video, your shot is coming more from your either in this section, I think it's in like this section here.
Yeah, because it kind of flies upward, kind of at an angle.
And so it's taking the blast like at that center of gravity. And then your battery pack is here. But it did look like in the video.
That's just insane, man. I wonder how much they're going to charge for this. This is made by Lockheed, right?
And actually, I made a mistake there. This is a Teledyne FLIR. So a correction, I did say Lockheed Martin. Teledyne FLIR.
Who knows how much they're going to charge for this? I think it's in combination with Lockheed, because I have seen that Black Hornet with Lockheed's name on it as well.
Potentially. If I hit play on this again, I just want to go with that. 300 meters. Oh, we're going to blast you guys with audio. Yeah, it doesn't even show, but...
yeah, I mean, they probably don't want to give away too many secrets.
Yeah. I was like, does it... That's the other question, though. Like, once this video... does it keep flying, I guess?
No, I mean, it's...
forward fragmenting.
It depends on what kind of charge they're using, I guess. Yeah, I don't think it's recovering from that.
Not from that. But very... But again, it goes back to, like, why is, you know... the whole Russia-Ukraine thing, they're using $500 drones. There's no way, when you look at just these payloads, just these gimbals, that this is going to be anywhere in the $500 price point for a
I would kamikaze. Say, considering, I think the Black Hornet is the very small one, right?
Super tiny.
It's about this big, yeah. Very I've seen tiny. Somewhere that costs like $120,000, so...
Yes. Again, they're selling this not in super high volume. This is like
And this is something SEAL Team 6 would use, just to say, you know.
Yeah, and that's a good point.
Like, you're just not giving these to everybody on the battlefield.
This thing weighs 1.3 kilograms. I mean, that's...
And that's just more or less for, like, surveillance. It's, I don't think it does anything crazy.
Recon, you know, putting this in a head, being able to, and then, but just to be able to see that, the size of that drone.
I would love to fly one of those.
Just in the hand right there. So, very... However, again, limitations. We talked about the light show drones. How much wind do you think this thing can handle, right? What's the performance capabilities? But
yeah, I guess there's no deployable. Way they're selling this yet, right?
Oh no, this is deployed. The Teledyne, the FLIR, the Black Hornet. This is 100%.
That's already out there.
Yeah, this yes. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah,
I
no,
what
this,
the limitations,
I mean,
are.
So they got the best of the thermal. They've got proven technology, very capable stuff. But in keeping on schedule here, some pretty cool stuff. Check that out. The Manta Ray, Northrop Grumman, and the Teledyne FLIR Rogue One, not Lockheed. Might be some Terry. I don't know. There could be some connection there. But as far as we're going with now, that is a Teledyne FLIR Rogue One drone. Moving along, you know, again, this segment will eventually, we want to get some listener question and answers going. But until we get to that point, we're going to touch on a kind of a neat thing for folks that are involved in the drones for environmental purposes, public safety, disaster, search and rescue, emergency response, emergency disaster management. Verizon and NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, super involved with weather forecasting, things of that nature. Verizon and NOAA have teamed up for advanced storm damage assessment. Verizon has a Verizon Frontline in-house team of UAS operators, a division focused on infrastructure surveillance. So when you get those hurricanes, tornadoes, those natural disasters that come through, sometimes in a very short period, you need to just capture a lot of area in a very short amount of time. So seeing Verizon team up with NOAA, you know, here on the East Coast, we're heading into hurricane season. I was at an event last week where someone mentioned that, and I don't even know, like they said, well, it's supposed to be a bad hurricane season. I was like, oh, well, that's awful. I just put my fence up, so hopefully my fence doesn't get knocked down this hurricane season. But with that said, really just interesting here. Again, also Verizon with the cellular side, usually after disaster, natural disasters, incidents of that nature, you end up seeing an impact on communications. So their ability to team up, cover areas. What do you guys think about this here? You guys familiar with Verizon Frontline?
I think that's going to be incredibly beneficial for people.
I mean, it's definitely going to be beneficial. Now, here, this might be a stupid question. When you say Verizon is trying to restore their telecommunications and their like internet service or whatever, do these drones have like receivers on them to produce that? Kind of do what the cell towers do, but in like a shorter range, or are they trying to get up to the cell towers and stuff and help them?
So I think at the front line, they have the ability to put up some of your standard drones. There are these devices known as COWs, or cellular on wheels. So when your standard infrastructure goes down, high winds, right? Your antenna on top of a 200-foot, 150-foot tower fails. They have a cellular on wheels vehicle that they can actually tow out on a behind a truck. They can activate it, turn it on, and that will kind of provide a stand-up network until things are repaired. Folks have, I don't know if there's any images of it here. So this looks like it could be a like a cellular on wheels.
That's guaranteed one. They put it on a diesel.
They want you've got your mast. You got your mast.
So I vaguely recall seeing backing up AT&T going to an event one time. I believe you might have been there, Paul. And they launched one of their drones up, and it was actually tethered. And I believe it was providing a kind of like an extender for emergency services, which was super cool. And I can see something like that being applicable here.
Yes, and I think that was at ETI. I think that's where it was at, and it could have been this.
Digging through my photos, trying to see if I can find something.
So here's a AT&T all-weather flying cow.
All-weather? That's all-weather? Okay. Wonder how they
hey,
did
it's
that.
Crazy. It's crazy what you'll learn could be all weather, because these things look open, but as long as they're coated, sealed, it's pretty interesting what.
Yeah, I guess there is ports that can kind of withstand it a bit.
And then you've got your tether, so you can put this up and get it to a very high vantage point and then put out that cellular signal in the event of a disaster. I think actually
that's the coolest looking drone I've seen personally, but just me talking. It's got the coolest design.
You got 8 motors, double redundancy. The color's cool.
It looks sick.
Yeah. AT&T, FirstNet. So each of these, because the cellular infrastructure is a critical part of our everyday, right? Whether it's through cellular or through, Cat 6 fiber optic or a traditional data cable. Being able to get out there and help, one, provide those temporary solutions to help first responders do their job, provide other drones, not just that do this to put it up, but they have the mapping capabilities, right, to map areas, get information up to the federal level in order to help get that funding, help get all those other agencies involved. So they're going to be able to do that very quickly, right, through their resources. And then by partnering with NOAA, what you're doing is you're bringing that data from current events to help forecast and project future events, because it's all about creating that advanced, outlook and those different models, per se.
Yeah. I bet, I'm sure it's already been used for this, but using drones to find flood zones is probably something worth looking into. Because, they can tell the altitude and whatever and map it out, and you can kind of see the low spots and areas.
Get that geospatial information.
Maybe a little bit more accurate than a satellite. I'm not familiar with satellite technology, but I feel like it probably would be more accurate than satellite.
It was like satellite can cover like a huge, huge area when the impact is extremely significant. And drones are great for more detailed information over a, smaller geographic region. And then their frontline folks are going to be, a lot of them are just made up of either volunteer, right, folks who have first responder backgrounds. So being able to integrate into the boots on the ground.
That's good. They have people that have that experience. So you, as much as we look at it, we don't know like all the uses and like ways to help the first responders. If you have the first responders there that have done it for 10, 20 years and they've like thought about it and they've just kind of brainstormed, they know how to use a drone better than we potentially would or any drone operator potentially would. And then
it's a huge opportunity to demonstrate technology capabilities. So they have things like this. They have resources that your traditional organizations just won't have because they're not responding to those types of incidents on a regular basis. So whether it's vehicles, drones, personnel, and then it's also an opportunity to, whether it's FirstNet and AT&T or Verizon, it's their way of getting into the community and not just saying, hey, this product works or this network is reliable. They can actually prove it. And networks, speaking of networks, kind of rolling into our last segment here of the hour for this podcast, which is covering more of the case studies and success stories. We talked about drone light shows last week and how absolutely fascinating they are. We had a chance to see one here locally, and then it just must have been, while we were recording the podcast, UVify is like, all right, well, here, go ahead and, hold my drink. We're gonna go ahead and set a new record. And then what's interesting is after this, it made me go back and look. And so I'm killing you with audio. We good?
Sounds good.
UVify attempts to break Guinness World Record with 5,700 plus drones. On the screen and video here, we see the COO of UVify talking. Tons of people are moving drones in line into position.
3, 2, 1, take off.
In today's EFO experience,
after seeing Sam Lorelli, like, after having seen 100 plus or so drones in the air, and like to see now the density of the pixels
on a scale that has never been done in history, what was once only a figment of imagination is now reality as part of UVify's effort to make.
But the animation and the
we shall continue to push the limits of creativity and technology.
Just years of hard work. You are officially amazing. 5,700 plus drones. New record for the most remote controlled multi-rotor drones in the air simultaneously. May 1st.
Just a heads up, Paul. I did not hear pretty much most of what you said during that video, so. But
I heard a
very
bit
cool
of it.
Video.
Yeah, just was kind of highlighting for folks watching what was happening. It was tons of drones. Like I was saying, Samuel, having seen now like a hundred or so drones in the air, to see the density of the pixels, because just here in their logo, like. So many drones, it's like watching, it's not even a drone light show anymore. It's like watching a floating TV.
It's very
because
crispy.
Of the density of the picture.
It's like going 720 to 4K, essentially.
Insane. And Terry, you were saying why 5,293, right? Why didn't they just make seven more?
That's probably a pain to lay all those out, though. Can you imagine, like, going through your pre-flight for all 5,000 drones?
Well, I was saying with Terry, I was like, well, they probably had like 5,800 laid out,
right?
And 107, haha, yeah, like part 107 of them didn't operate, because when you have 5,700 plus drones, what are the odds? And I could be completely wrong. If they were able to get a 100% takeoff launch flight out of 5,793 drones, like, that's insane. But my thought there was like, maybe they had more than that, but a few just didn't launch. So the final number, but
I have to say,
I wasn't there.
From everyone's personal experience, I don't think we've had such luck with technology ever, anyone, you know, just all flawlessly taking off, you know.
Yeah, sometimes in baseball, right, 30% is winning. Going 1-for-3, and you could end up in the Hall of Fame.
Notably, that story was in South Korea as well. I don't know if you saw that part.
Yeah, that's a great point to make. South Korea, UVify, they're always out at exponential commercial UAV. So to see these drones in person and they're out there, they're trying to sell them, they're trying to, you know, make this the big wave. And then one thing I just wanted to highlight was an article in Drone Life by a Malik Murison. This was posted on July 18th of 2018, so almost 6 years ago. Intel sets new drone light show record at their 50th anniversary party. So the article states that they flew 2018 drones in Folsom, California. Got some photos here. Got a video. This is like a few hours long. Drone team, Intel drone team. So folks know Intel, huge, massive company. They took a little tiny bit and they at one point they kind of put it into drones. They had some light shows. They had a multi-rotor type aircraft going. Oh, this is a really long one, huh? Goodness.
Very thorough. Got some good animations, though.
Oh, there's an Intel. There's a little. Hey, you see that little chip? A little chipper? It's so cool because there's actually like three images in there right now. They just haven't. It's like they haven't activated the next thing. So cool. With 2018 drones, right? And I'm like, why 2018? Why do you think they did 2018?
Year 2018.
The year 2018. There you go. How awesome. They got the globe. So 2018, right? Record was set. 2018 drones. Here we are now, 6 years later. 5,700. And 5,293 drones. How awesome.
I just want to also kind of put out for reference, like the drone show we saw was probably, I think, a fleet of 50 at once. So just seeing something like this, this is insane. And I'm personally excited to see something like that in person.
Yeah, this is the one here. I just see it and I just think how dense the drone. So the more drones, the more detailed the picture you can tell. And so they've gone from making, it's not even like making shapes or figures with the drones. It's, although they are, like you see here, but it's being able to make a floating screen. And then you could probably just play, you know, a video and it would, this is insane. This is so cool. So folks, check out UVify if you're listening on the audio only, once you have a chance. And what's really amazing is right, this video is posted 6 days ago. 1,800 views, you know, 1,800 views, Guinness record, 5,293, you know. And then we talk about military and this whole swarming. That's wild. This is insane. We're so fortunate to be in a position to watch this technology just flourish on the civilian side, really. And gosh, to kind of only imagine what type of implications this is going to carry into the, you know, defense side of things. It is certainly a a fascinating time. And a whopping 1800, not even 1800, because I've watched it like three times and someone else has probably watched it three times. So there's like 400 people who have, just kidding. Check it out. UFI world record. What are you guys' thoughts on that?
Have you guys ever seen the like uncontacted tribe? I think it's off the coast of India.
I know what you mean.
Could you imagine going to them and putting a drone light show up in front of them of like a face talking or something? That wasn't original, but like I've seen people suggest we do that with those. It's just, even if you showed somebody in the 40s, like if you went back to the 40s and you showed somebody that, they would be scared. They wouldn't know what was happening.
I mean, I feel like there's even still like a slight fear now, but I mean, I'm saying that jokingly, but it's still, it's a massive thing to look at. And you look at it in awe because our mind is just trying to comprehend what we're looking at, because where are they standing up on? What's holding the lights up, you know? So, I mean, probably a couple generations are going to be like, oh yeah, it's just a drone. But I mean, me personally, I'm kind of like, oh my gosh, that's crazy. But yeah, I mean,
it's the gods.
Yeah.
Yeah. What they would do, the things that they would think and write, and the, it's just, again, it's like the, what you see transforms where you end up. Just like we talked about the video games and how being able to see such realistic things show up in a TV, and then the uses, it was like, now here it is. The tribe that I know, at first I was like, what is he talking about? And then I was like, yeah, I've seen that video where they like flew a helicopter or a plane. There's like one video of like those folks that no one's ever talked to. Almost here in closing, sticking to our schedule, we got our little regulatory corner. One thing I just wanted to bring up, part five, folks may not be entirely familiar with, the Code of Federal Regulations, FAR 14 CFR part five. But part five covers safety management systems. And there is a final rule that was published on April 26th. The effective date for this final rule is May 28th. And then there's going to be like a 60-day period to publish or to submit some outlines, but then a 3-year, a 36-month period where Part 135 operators, Part 20 manufacturers are all going to have to implement a safety management system, which is a basically a process-driven and systematic approach, right? It provides a structured, repeatable, systematic approach to proactively identify hazards and manage safety risk. So up until this point, I believe it's the 121, you know, your air carriers and things of that nature have had to have a safety management system, but now effective May 28th, your drone manufacturers, or not drone manufacturers, your aircraft manufacturers, so potentially folks manufacturing drones under a production certificate or a type certificate, and then your Part 135 operators, including your, you know, 135 UAS air carriers are all going to have a safety management system in place. So just a little fun fact, you can check that out. That's a part five, final ruling that just came out at the end of April. Any thoughts, SMS? You guys think safety?
Safety is a big thing for sure. I'm just kind of, as you're talking over it, reading up on it, it sounds like it's something I myself have to read up a little bit on before I say anything.
And it's one of those things where if you're 107, that doesn't apply to 107 still. I mean, folks that are getting waivers, there's sometimes a provisional requirement for an SMS, but you know, SMS, you're either doing it or you're not. And here we go, a little cutting in here, right? You're either doing it or you're not. There's safe, and then there's SMS safe. And again, having a systematic thorough approach to identify and mitigate risks is super important for folks that, want to scale aviation operations. So check that out if you're looking for a little bit of material at night to kind of help you go to sleep. You can read through the part 5 final ruling. And with that said, I just want to go into some closing remarks here. We really appreciate everybody tuning in, your time, your attention, going through the privacy stuff, ACLU, Michigan Supreme Court, some of the articles that Jim Milligan put out over this past week, dronelife.com. We touched on the Northrop Grumman Man Array. We talked about the Teledyne FLIR Rogue One drone. Highlighted Verizon and NOAA teaming up to help first responders, you know, quickly collect data and respond to natural disasters and emergency incidents. How cool UVify sets a new record, 5,293 drone light show in, as Samuel pointed out, South Korea. So now ball is back in the court of the United States. We need to do a, 6,000 drone light show. Who's going to do it? If you need help, give us a call. Regulatory Corner, check out part 105, safety management. Good reading material to help you get some shut eye. Terry, Samuel, any closing thoughts, remarks?
I mean, we gave it, a couple days, and the next thing you know, we have another big drone light show news. So I'm kind of interested to see what big news we have for next week's episode,
100%.
Yeah, sure something will pop off.
So much happens in a week. It's really cool, too, now that we're doing the podcast here, to actually see these different things, articles, products, like Terry's been mentioning. We've got a little communication Discord channel we get to use for throwing stuff out there in preparation. And it's really exciting to now see this stuff and then know we're going to be able to bring it to the audience, to the listeners, and to the folks tuning in. So again, thank you everybody for your time, your attention, for engaging with dronelife.com, and for allowing us the opportunity here to present weekly wings and connect with you in regards to all that is happening in the UAS industry. Thank you, everybody, and we will see you next week.